Good morning. I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International from the studios of KBZT FM 94.9 in San Diego. Tree Huggers International is a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program dedicated to the preservation of parks, wilderness, and special places. From the beaches to the mountains to the deserts, this is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. The Gulf of Mexico oil spill has reminded us in a colossal and tragic manner of the dangers and consequences of deepwater offshore oil drilling. So far, oil has washed up on the beaches in Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, with Louisiana in particular hardest hit, although Mississippi and Alabama have had their Gulf Coast severely affected by the oil spill as well. Oil has now even entered the mouth of the Mississippi River, site of some of the most delicate and environmentally important wetlands in the nation. 630 miles of the Gulf Coast altogether have been affected by the oil spill. Along the Gulf Coast, whole fishing and tourist-based livelihoods have been wiped out, or so severely impaired they may never recover. One-third of all fishing areas in the Gulf of Mexico have been closed indefinitely. The consequences to deep-sea marine life and the wetlands which buffer the Gulf Coast are still in the process of being calculated, but in the end, they may be more than we, or the natural ecosystems of the region, can bear. It is also worth remembering and reminding those in charge. 11 men lost their lives in the blast of the Deepwater Horizon on April the 20th. Well, Surfrider is an organization we often work with here at Tree Huggers International. They've long taken a stand against offshore oil drilling, and two gentlemen, Jared Criscuolo and Christian Gustafson, met while doing some work for the Surfrider Foundation, and together they formed a nonprofit organization called Below the Surface. Below the Surface is focused on promoting water conservation and improving water quality in our rivers and our oceans. And just last year, Christian canoed down the length of the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico as part of Below the Surface's downstream campaign. And the contacts Christian and Jared made during this awareness-raising trip and other expeditions of the Mississippi's tributaries paid dividends when Below the Surface returned to the region this spring to respond to the oil spill crisis. And their work was most recently detailed in a Reader's Digest article, and they have a cable TV show in the works too. So joining us today on Tree Huggers International is Below the Surface co-founder Jared Criscuolo, a longtime environmental advocate, a surfer, and a volunteer with the Surfrider Foundation. Jared, it's good to have you here. Welcome to Tree Huggers International. Welcome.
Thanks, Tommy. I'm really happy to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk with you.
Well, I want to talk about your experiences at the Gulf of Mexico and seeing the damage there, but first of all, how did Below the Surface come together? What was the motivation behind it? Did you feel there was an aspect of river or water conservation which wasn't being addressed?
When it came to starting Below the Surface, it was almost sort of the perfect storm, if you will, in a positive sense for Christian and I. Christian and I met through the Surfrider Foundation here in San Diego. I was involved with the executive committee at the time, had been very involved with a chapter on a number of campaigns, including Know Your H2O. Basically, what happened for me was I grew up in New England, and I grew up surfing in New England. In New England, one can surf after a rainstorm, and the conditions really aren't that bad. It usually accompanies a hurricane swell, which brings great waves. So as a surfer in New England, we go surfing after the rainstorms. We don't think twice about it. I moved to San Diego in February of 2006, and excited to be here and be able to surf year-round, I jumped into the water, went surfing right after a rainstorm. The consequence of that was I was in bed for almost a week sick. I've come to find out since then that because of the way that Southern California is built from a civil engineering perspective, our rivers are paved over, most of the storm drains dump directly onto the beaches or into the oceans, or at least the lagoons, and then ultimately the oceans, one cannot surf or be in the water, swim, kayak, whatever it may be. You don't want to go in the water after it rains because of the level of pollution. I got really upset about it, and then I decided to do something about it. So that's how I joined Surfrider, and wanted to expand beyond what we were doing on the chapter level, and realized to do that, we needed to start looking upstream. And at the same time, Christian was a student at University of California, San Diego, and he had done an independent study with a professor there about the Mississippi River. He wanted to paddle the Mississippi, thought it would be the adventure of a lifetime. His uncles had done it in 1966, and this was kind of a follow-on in 2008 of their adventure. So Christian got ready to do this expedition. He also did an independent study on the Mississippi River and how it's impacting the Gulf of Mexico. You know, just for perspective, there's an area, a hypoxic zone in the Gulf. It's 8,000 square miles, or roughly the size of the state of Massachusetts, that doesn't support any life. And that is the consequence of all of the pollution and runoff that comes down the Mississippi River and dumps into the Gulf. So there have been problems down there that long predate the Deepwater Horizon disaster. But Christian did that. I was working with him kind of as a friend and advisor, giving him advice. And then we decided to come together and start Below the Surface as an exploration of rivers to oceans to help people make visually and on a personal level that connection between what we do upstream and how it affects things downstream.
This hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico, why didn't we ever really hear about this before? Because we hear a lot now about the North Pacific Gyre, and I realized a couple of years ago that wasn't really familiar to a lot of Americans. But you know, you say 40 years this has been around, and we're only becoming aware of it now. Why do you think that is?
I would say it's not very visual. And you know, that kind of gets back to what we do and why we do it. The North Pacific garbage patch is something that hasn't really been seen or talked about up until the last couple of years. But once it was discovered, and once people like Charlie Moore, the guy who found it, brought the pictures, brought the images, brought samples back, and we started seeing more and more photographs of dead albatross on the beach and looking at their skeletons and seeing their entire, where their stomach would have been were they alive, filled with plastic bottles, plastic caps, cigarette lighters, you know, all of these things that have no business being in places like Midway Island, which is in the middle of the Pacific, or the Pacific Gyre, which is 1,000 miles from land. People started to realize the impacts of our actions, and I think that's why people got excited and upset about it. Whereas with the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico, you can't really see it. It's not something that impacts us directly. You know, you don't see necessarily dead animals. Animals basically stay away from it. And because of that, it's hard to create an emotional connection to it. And I think that's why people haven't gotten upset about it. And frankly, this was discovered 40 years ago. It's not a new phenomenon. It's not something that just suddenly cropped up. It's been growing and growing over time. And there's been a lot of research done on that, but it just really, again, hasn't touched people on an emotional level.
And these researchers have been able to trace back a lot of the sources for this hypoxic zone to materials that came down the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico, fertilizers, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's the result of a chain reaction, nothing direct. When you look at things like nitrogen and phosphates, that fosters growth. So farmers, rightly, have to use that to help grow crops. But when you have massive expanses of farms where fertilizers and pesticides are spread over hundreds, if not thousands, of acres, and then all that washes off during a rainstorm, if there's no mechanism in place to capture that runoff and filter it before it hits a river, and it's not even directly in the Mississippi, but the tributaries of the Mississippi, the streams and the smaller rivers that lead to the Mississippi, all of that flows off the land, it enters the rivers. When you mix those things, those compounds, with water, and then maybe some algae that's existing in a river, that fosters an algae bloom. Algae feeds off of oxygen, and it's that compounded effect of thousands of farms, thousands of our yards where we're using fertilizers and pesticides to grow more grass, for example, that adds up over time, and with the multiplier effect of millions, tens, hundreds of millions of people throughout the Midwest, throughout 42% of the country draining into the Mississippi River.
And decades of use.
You know, that's what has caused this problem. That's what has caused this hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
And, of course, there was a big oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 1979 off of the Mexican coast.
Right.
So the Gulf of Mexico, it's already not the healthiest body of water compared to some other seas on the globe. Obviously, the Louisiana coast, the Texas coast there is enormously industrialized. The oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico it made things worse, but I think we were already reaching the point where how much worse could it get?
Yeah, one of our key team members, Guy McClellan, he's our science and technical advisor. He's a chemist by training, phenomenally intelligent person and a great resource. He did a little research project. He took a Google Earth map and he went through a number of different government agencies that issue discharge permits or different permits, leases related to anything that could possibly affect water quality, from mines to the pollution discharge permits that factories and facilities apply for, businesses apply for. It covers, you know, a broad swath, and I won't bore you with the details, but the long and the short of it is we were able to look at that, and then he found all of the hypoxic zones along the Gulf, the coast of the U.S. There's over 400 throughout the world, and there's 40 in the coastal waters of the United States, and they've ranged in size from fairly small to the one in the Gulf of Mexico we're just talking about. So this is it's sort of an unintended barrage on the coastline that we're facing as not just to the environmental community, but society as a whole. Fishermen deal with this. You know, anyone who lives on the coastline, anyone who has a vacation house deals with this. Anyone who used to fish 30, 40 years ago and saw great fishing on the coast of the U.S. and has seen that depleted and diminished is dealing with that.
Why are the wetlands along the Mississippi and the Gulf Coast so important, and how have they been affected by the oil spill?
The marshlands and the wetlands are important for a few different reasons. From an ecological perspective, it's a beautiful area, and it allows the growth of new life. From a human perspective, 80% of the fish that are caught in the Gulf of Mexico are spawned in the marshlands along the coastline. So that whole industry that we're now saying is basically destroyed for the next decade to decade and a half in the Gulf of Mexico because of this oil spill are dependent upon those marshlands that are now covered in oil that won't be able to produce any life. They're also important from sort of a public safety perspective. The marshlands that are on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico absorb the brunt of force from the hurricanes that hit every single year. Now, a problem that we're having in the Gulf of Mexico is that in Louisiana in particular, we lose about 100 yards of soil, of land, every 38 minutes. Over 2,300 miles of coastline have been lost in the last 70 years. The reason behind that is that in order to ensure that the Mississippi River flows in a steady, consistent course, which naturally it doesn't, it's held seven different courses over the last 4,500 years. But the Mississippi River itself is set up with levees, and those levees make sure that ships can go back and forth past New Orleans up a steady path. It's good for the economy. There's no doubt about that. And it's fostered a lot of growth in manufacturing and in farming in the Midwest. The downside for the coast perspective is that same levying effect, that channelization effect, takes all the soil and sediment that would otherwise run from the mountains up in Minnesota and the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachian Mountains and make its way down and then redistribute naturally along the coastline to provide that buffer, to protect people from hurricanes, to provide land for fish to spawn in. All of that is being dumped into the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, and it has for 70 years. And since that sediment and sand is not redistributing along the shoreline, that's why we're losing coast in the Gulf. So then having an oil spill means we're going to have to scrape even more of that out, so it accelerates the loss of land that we're experiencing.
And Below the Surface also undertook an expedition of a tributary of the Mississippi, which was the river's most recent course, like you were saying, before its current course. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, we, in February of this year, 2010, Christian organized an expedition on the Atchafalaya River. He brought me along. Our scientific advisor, Guy, came with us. We had a writer named Steve Chappell who came on behalf of Reader's Digest, a photographer, Erica Larson, who came on behalf of Reader's Digest, and then John Ruskey of the Quapaw Canoe Company in Clarksburg, Mississippi, came with us as well. So we had this large group of people that came together. We met up with people from the Audubon Society. We met up with people from Riverkeeper, from Basin Keeper, all different groups that were working in the area that have been working for years on a variety of issues, including the sediment issue that we just talked about, including protecting the cypress forests, which are getting cut down in record levels by companies that make mulch for our gardens out of them. Those are extremely valuable trees, and they're very rare now because of that. And we explored the river itself. Now, the Atchafalaya is unique. It's a 180-mile-long offshoot of the Mississippi River, and it's called a distributary. There's a dam that basically modulates the flow of water from the Mississippi down the Atchafalaya. If that dam were not in place, the old river control structure, the Mississippi River over time would have carved its way into what is now the Atchafalaya River, and it would have reformed its path. Now, there'd still be water flowing down the existing Mississippi, but the problem that we would face from an infrastructure level is that ships wouldn't be able to go up and down the Mississippi. So we went down this river to see what happens when a river is allowed to basically flow free. Because once you get below the old river control structure, there aren't any controls. There's not a heavy effort of channelizing. The river just flows, and it's all swamps down there. And it is beautiful, Tommy. Millions of acres of swamps. In the summer season, there's alligators. There's legions of snakes, something in the neighborhood of 40 plus different types of, or excuse me, there's 300 different types of birds there. It is an absolutely gorgeous, wild wilderness experience.
And this is in Louisiana?
This is in Louisiana.
There's no major towns or anything along the banks?
Just a couple small ones. But it's mostly bayou and swamp living. It's people that live off the land. They're fishermen. They rely on the health of the ecosystem down there. They get it because that's what they live off of.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International, broadcast from the studios of KBZT FM 94.9 in San Diego. I'm Tommy Helm, and we're joined in the studio by the co-founder of Below the Surface, Jared Criscuolo. And we're talking about Jared's and Below the Surface's recent visit to the Gulf of Mexico in the wake of the BP oil spill. Below the Surface is a nonprofit organization focused on promoting water conservation and improving water quality in our rivers and our oceans. And you can learn more about Below the Surface at www.belowthesurface.org. That's belowthesurface.org. And Jared, while you and Christian were along the Gulf Coast, you attended town hall meetings in Mississippi. You met with former oil workers and Native American representatives while you were in the region. What did you see on the ground? What did you learn?
In a couple of words, it's the worst thing to ever happen to the Gulf of Mexico. That's it. This spill has touched people on a lot of different levels. It's destroyed the environment. It's destroyed a centuries-old economy. In the case of the native tribe that we visited, it's destroyed their lifestyle. I mean, they have been living off the land for over 400 years. And we had a writer with us from Audubon Magazine, and I can't quite exactly remember his quote, but it was something along the lines of, this group of people has survived storms, they've survived hurricanes, manifest destiny, alcohol, all sorts of plagues and diseases over 400 years, but they're really at a loss for how to handle this situation because all of those things they've been able to bounce back from, but this is destroying the next decade's worth of fishing, which is what they rely on to survive. But we saw a lot when we were there. We stayed in Mississippi with a couple that we met there, Pat and Liz. Pat's actually been working with us more and more and has kind of taken the helm on some of the local issues there. We've got a group of professional surfers that are going to be working with him for a fundraiser event in September, which we're really excited about. But yeah, we went to a town hall meeting and we saw everything from people just asking and being polite to one fisherman who got up and tore into the officials from NOAA, from the Coast Guard, one of the vice presidents from BP that was there to represent the company, and other agencies that are involved, Environmental Protection Agency. And he had his son, his 16-year-old son, stand up and said, my boy was going to be a fisherman like me and like the generations before me, but now he can't. And that's the feeling there, is that people have been robbed of their livelihood. I would posit their dignity in some regards, their ability to be self-sufficient, to live off of the land, to provide for themselves, provide for their families, and frankly, to provide some of the best seafood that a lot of this country enjoys. One of the spots that we stopped was a local seafood store, and we spoke with the guys there, and you know, they were as optimistic as one could be in a situation like that, but basically they said they're not going to be able to harvest fish from the Gulf of Mexico through their fishing crews like they used to, so they're going to have to look to Chile and China and all these other parts of the country. And a startling revelation is that 80% of the seafood that we consume comes from abroad right now. It's not caught domestically.
You met with an oil worker who had some different ideas as to what BP could have been doing. And I imagine everyone there has an opinion. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine, obviously, there's a lot of oil company expertise in the region. Mm-hmm. What was this gentleman saying that really seemed to resonate with you and Christian?
Well, just for the purpose of qualifying him, this gentleman has a couple decades of experience in handling offshore rigs at a fairly high level. You know, he wasn't just a basic pipe fitter. He was fairly well experienced in sort of the whole picture. His reaction was very simply, if this was my project, what I would do is I would fashion a blow-off preventer valve, I would figure out a way to get down there, rip the old one off, install the new one, and cap it off. And this was a week after the initial spill happened, he was saying this. And we've seen BP try a number of different approaches, and ultimately the approach that they've settled on, and maybe it's because it took them long enough to make a blow-off preventer valve that would actually work, or maybe it's because they wanted to try other ways to capture the oil and keep the well productive because of the billions of dollars they probably spent designing and drilling the well. They've finally come to that 86 some odd days later.
This is only conjecture, but do you feel from talking to this gentleman and other people you interacted with while you were there, do you feel that BP was trying to keep an eye on its investment and potentially somehow salvage that well, salvage it so they could use it again?
I think that, you know, from a shareholder perspective, BP'd be irresponsible if they didn't try to. I'm not saying I agree with that, but, you know, if you look back to traditional economic theory, Hans Morgenthau, you can find in his writings a quote, roughly the social responsibility of a, the responsibility of a corporation is the profits of its shareholders. You know, that's who they answer to. That's what their ultimate responsibility is. So with that in mind, I would not be surprised if that was what was guiding their decision-making process. I know that if you look at it from a strategic perspective, they have a few things in their hand that was playing in their favor. For example, after the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989, the 1990 Oil Spill Act capped the liability for offshore spills at $75 million. BP wrote a check for $100 million within the first week and spread it out between the four coastal states of the Gulf of Mexico. So essentially, they had met their liability. Now, I don't know the inner workings of the law and how they would have gotten around that or any subsequent liability under different laws and acts. But nevertheless, they have an investment that they made, and they want to make sure that that investment produces something. They want to get a return off of it. They don't want to lose money. And they've lost a significant amount of money since then. But given that, given how they treated fishermen and the workers on the rig when it initially exploded, I was told, and again, this is, you know, this is essentially hearsay. It's what people talked about. But, you know, I've got this from a girl whose family works in the oil industry. The people that were involved on the Deepwater Horizon rig that were rescued were kept for 40 hours, 15 of them on the boat and 20 on in a hotel until they agreed to sign non-disclosure agreements about the incident, that they basically wouldn't talk to the press. They waived their legal rights to any recourse from it. I mean, it was very, very shady legal machination behind this. Fishermen to participate in the Vessels of Opportunity program that was offered by BP, which paid them, I think it was something in the neighborhood of $5,000 a day to be able to go out and spread boom after the spill to try to contain it. They had to sign agreements that said that they would not sue. They would not hold BP responsible for any health damages related to their experience there. You know, those types of things, that type of approach, I understand that they've got to protect themselves, but they've caused one of the worst man-made disasters probably in the history of the country, if not the world. I mean, I don't have much to compare it to at this point off the top of my head, but definitely in the history of this country. And people are being marginalized. They had no choice. If I was a fisherman in the Gulf and I saw the coastal waters closed and the federal waters closed to fishing and I saw this oil spill happening, I would be doing one of two things. I'd try to sell my boats as soon as possible at the best rate before the market was inundated with boats being sold, or I would grab on the first opportunity I could to make money to feed my family. You know, I think everybody accepts the fact that oil is intrinsically tied to everything that we do. I don't like it, and I know a lot of people don't like it, but the fact of the matter is, you know, the oil industry has their hands in everything from, you know, the plastics and the housing on the cables in the studio that we're in right now to the dyes in the clothing that we're wearing, to the colors on our cars. I mean, even if we ran our cars on vegetable oil, there's still going to be some oil involved in making the componentry and running the engine and the diesel that goes into it. So we can't get away from oil. The problem, though, is that the interests of oil in this particular situation are being put above the interests, or have forced themselves above the interests, of fishermen and their families, because the fishermen rely on a healthy, sound environment to continue their trade. The oil industry relies on extracting a resource. And I know the talking points for the industry. You know, I've heard on an interview with the chairman of BP yesterday that there have been 5,000 wells drilled in the last 30 years in the Gulf, and this is the only major spill that we know about. So those statistics don't look all that bad when you look at it from a statistical perspective. The problem is the stakes are huge. BP has lost a fairly significant chunk of its shareholder value because of this spill, and will continue to, rightfully so, because of what they've caused. It's a high-stakes game of poker. The Gulf has lost an entire economy because of this. You know, people have basically lost the choice to work for themselves or go work for a big corporation. And that, I mean, as an underlying principle, that violates everything about the American character. Going back 250 years to, I believe it was Thomas Jefferson or Andrew Jackson's vision of the yeoman farmer who supports himself and, you know, supports his community. It completely shakes the social fabric of this country to have that type of ability or choice taken away. And I think that's what you're seeing.
Did you see any of the damage?
We saw a little bit of it, and it was a little indirect. The big concern when we were down there in mid-May was the use of dispersants. The problem with dispersants is it takes what's sitting on the surface, which I, from what I understand, some of that oil would evaporate naturally, but it takes that sheen of oil on the surface, breaks it up, and then striates it. And in some of the information that we got, up to 3,000-foot striations of sort of a loose solution floating through the ocean. So you've got this corridor that animals are swimming through. They can't really get around. They're ingesting and eating. A couple of things that we saw that stood out were we went out to Ship Island, which is off of the coast of Gulfport, Mississippi. And when we got out there, we went for a walk around the perimeter of the island. It's a fairly small island, a couple of miles. We came across a dead baby dolphin, and we came across a dead sea turtle. And this was a massive sea turtle, like the size of the hood of a small car. Size sea turtle, you know, not a baby. Now, in and of itself, we saw those and we said, all right, you know, maybe it's related to the oil spill, maybe not. There was no oil on it, so there was no sort of visual connection. We walked over to the ranger station. We told the park ranger what we saw, and he said, oh, okay, great, thanks. You know, I appreciate it. We'll get that taken care of. And then he quickly said, those have been there for 6 weeks. I said, oh.
Okay.
All right, you know, we were sort of hoping that that wasn't the case because it would sort of bolster our point. But you said, all right, fine. You know, it's been here for 6 weeks. Then it's not related to the oil spill, and all the better. Maybe it's not having that big of an issue. We took a reporter out there who was over from Norway later that afternoon and went for a walk past the spot. We showed him what we saw. And I told him the story about what the park ranger said. And he said, that's not possible. And I said, why? He said, because I was here last Sunday. This was a week prior. We were there on a Sunday. He said, I was here last Sunday, and I walked the same stretch of beach, and neither one of these were here. Once all this dissolved, striated oil slash dispersion combo gets out into the Gulf Stream itself wraps around Florida and makes its way up the East Coast and only shoots back out into the Atlantic Ocean around New Jersey. So we're talking about the entire eastern seaboard. If the dispersant has the impact that we're hearing that researchers are pointing to, then we've got a bigger problem. And to that end, on research, BP has been buying up scientific expertise in the Gulf. And what I mean by that, because it sounds a little loaded, is they're making very, very generous offers to researchers that are top in their field in the ocean range in that area. And they're basically saying, we're going to fund your research, but we own the rights to any findings you have.
Which means they can shelve it if they don't like it.
Exactly. They can use it however they want to in whatever way. They can bury it. They can make it publicly available. Whatever they want to do, whatever's in their best interest at that point in time. Now, the U.S. government, some of the agencies that issue grants are saying, fine, if you, the researcher, takes a grant from BP, you lose funding from our government, and vice versa. That's a problem that we're seeing, is there's sort of a paucity of good, solid scientific data available because of that. We're a coast-to-coast exploration of America's waterways. And our focus, our mantra, if you will, is be the solution. We want people to be the solution to water waste and pollution. Because at the end of the day, you know, like we were talking about on the Mississippi River before with the hypoxic zone in the Gulf, it's what each of us do as individual citizens. You know, this cup of coffee that I'm drinking right here, I've got a choice of whether or not to use a plastic stirrer. I have a choice of whether or not to buy a plastic water bottle, a Poland Spring or an Aquafina or whatever it may be, bottle of water, or I can just take my stainless steel water bottle here and fill it up at the tap. But it's all about finding solutions, and that's what we do. So we're focused on America right now. We'll go throughout the world when the time is right, But, you know, we're American citizens. We love our country. We want to see it be a better, greater place. So that's why we're focused here. Christian is actually, he's our Midwest expedition leader. He's focused on the Midwest. He's from Illinois. He grew up on the rivers up there, and he basically has, you know, metaphorically made his way to the ocean. For me, I come from the East Coast. I'm from New England. I grew up on the beaches in New England, and I went to school in New York State in the Adirondacks, was a guide at my alma mater, and have a very strong connection. I always have had a strong connection from the time I was 6 months old with my grandfather carrying me in the woods on his chest, eating saltines and peanut butter and hiking on the trails and playing in the streams, to now I've always had a strong connection to Earth, to the land. So we cover the whole country with our expeditions because we want to get people in the rivers. We want people to canoe and stand up paddleboard and kayak and swim and be out there, because it's that personal connection with water or with the land that helps people to think about it a little bit differently and not be completely isolated from it.
And make those choices responsibly.
Exactly.
Gives them something else to think about.
It changes your baseline. You know, at Surfrider, we've got a program, we talk about shifting baselines. And the idea is people's baseline of what they expect for the environment changes over time and, frankly, degrades over time because we become used to a little bit more plastic on the beaches and a little more plastic in the ocean and a little more pollution. And we go from 100% beach opening to 90 to 80 to 70% beach openings.
Right.
And we're okay with it. And then we're okay with, well, I can't surf when it's, you know, when the water's polluted, so I'm going to wait 72 hours and then go surfing afterwards. And people just sort of accept that because we're busy with our day-to-day lives. There's nothing against people. We're losing touch with the earth around us. So we, through our expeditions and through our media focus, want to get people back out there, enjoying it, taking ownership for the world around us.
And there's more information at belowthesurface.org.
Exactly, yeah.
Belowthesurface.org. Jared Criscuolo, time just flies right by, doesn't it?
It does, unfortunately.
I know there's a lot more we could talk about, and we'll have to have you and Christian on again sometime.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, we'll come both in and talk about some of the things. We've got some great projects coming up on the West Coast. We discovered an oyster farm. We're really excited about oyster farming as a way to help clean the water because it feeds off pollution in the water. Google's given us some support through giving us access to their Google Earth Pro software. So we're slowly building, and I look forward to coming back once we finalize things. We're working with a partner that's a large multinational company that's very interested in some of the technology behind how that works. In addition to encourage people to get out on the rivers, we also want to have a good takeaway. We envision putting together a watershed monitoring network that we can roll out on every single river. It'd be privately funded, so we have an independent, verifiable source of data on what is getting in our waterways, and then we can find solutions. And frankly, if it's business solutions, I don't care, but some type of private sector solutions to incentivize businesses to come in, make the filtration and cleanup technology available so that companies and farms along rivers can clean up their water so we all enjoy cleaner rivers, cleaner oceans, and cleaner beaches.
Jared, good having you on, man.
Thanks,
I'm looking
Tommy.
Forward to having you back on again. This is just outstanding.
Yeah, every time I get to see you, it's a pleasure, man. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And thank you for making the time to come in today, especially on the heels of your trip to the Gulf of Mexico and just everything that you saw there. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
BelowTheSurface.org, again, is the website. That's BelowTheSurface.org. Jared, tell Christian I said hi, and we'll see you next time.
I will. Take care, Tommy.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International on FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Howe. Thanks once again to Jared Criscuolo from Below the Surface for joining us. If you want more information about Below the Surface and their activism and work promoting water conservation and improving water quality in our rivers and our oceans, go to belowthesurface.org. That's www.belowthesurface.org. There's also video and additional information on Christian and Jared's expeditions along Mississippi's Sunflower River and their 300-mile spring to sand trap expedition, paddling from the headwaters of the American River at the base of Mount Shasta to the Sacramento Delta. Check it out at belowthesurface.org. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media. And as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, you can go ahead and email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. And for more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, go to the Tree Huggers International website at www.treehuggersinternational.com. treehuggersintl.com. That's treehuggersintl.com. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego. We'll be back same time next Sunday morning with another take on natural science and environmental affairs as we continue our mission to preserve parks, wilderness, and special places on Tree Huggers International. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and be well.